Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you. Ohenya?
Yes, thank you,
Stu. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having us here today.
You're working in a very interesting part of the population, trying to help people deal with severe chemical dependency. And that's really what it is, isn't it? Like, when I look at the issue, especially around heroin use and opioids of that nature, I think, okay, at some point in your life, these people decided to inject a substance into their body that now, in essence, owns them. And how important is it that we recognize that this is a medical condition rather than just a substance abuse?
What I think is interesting how you started your question is at some point somebody decided to inject heroin. And for many of us at some point in our life when we start thinking about this issue, is the idea that it seems that that is the moment where everything changes.
Yes.
The thing is, for the people we are trying to reach, things were already not good.
True. I'm not saying that they made an informed decision, but they did make a decision. And every decision affects the outcome of our lives, for all of us.
Well,
and it doesn't matter where you're at in life. So you make that kind of...
It does matter. So if I
I'm just saying that the consequences of every decision, like, they play themselves out. Where you are at, and I'll agree with you, and am I making an informed decision? There's a whole bunch of circumstances that go into that.
Well, the thing is, it's not enough to inject heroin to become dependent on heroin. It's not enough. You see...
This is not a one-time event, then.
It's not a one-time event. It has to feel better than not being injecting. It has to feel better than the reality you're living in. It has to feel better than being on your own. You see, I always think, like, you know, what if my children got, and, you know, and for some reasons in life ended up injecting heroin?
Possible.
It is absolutely possible. Nothing.
Yeah.
Especially those who have children know that you control pretty much nothing after you put them in the school system. So the point is, well, is that going to make the point where they are going to end up day in, day out for 15 years, like the people we are trying to reach with this treatment, for 15 years injecting heroin in the downtown east side in an alley? It is kind of unlikely. It is possible, but it's unlikely. Why? Because, well, I have to say, we are quite privileged. So I will have a basket of resources that I'm going to start throwing at the situation. So when we think of what are the people we are trying to reach, is people that, yes, they have had an encounter with injecting heroin, but at the same time, their recovery capital has been drained.
What do you mean by recovery capital?
Well, let's imagine that, you know, you have no housing. You have no education. You come from a family where there has a historical trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You come from a family where there is mental illness. Nobody can take care of you. Or when you were very young, you were a subject of child abuse, physical, mental, emotional, sexual. So at that point, there is so many things that you need help with, that injecting heroin, it is one portion that is going to make everything worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because we use drugs for a reason, and it's because they feel good.
Yeah. Or escape. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And escapes feels good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that moment when you decide you're going to binge on TV and you forget about all the works and the problems that you have in life, and it feels like, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to say how will I feel on heroin because personally I haven't tried, but I do know what it feels to have some sort of relief when things are not going right.
So, as I hear you explain this, I don't want to give the idea that it's only people who come from challenging environments that can find themselves in a situation where they become opioid or heroin
Absolutely
addictive.
Right.
Because I know people who came from very good circumstances and you think, how'd you wind up there? But there they are.
Exactly.
And they all get to the point where the ability to deal with this is beyond them.
Exactly. So that is exactly the point we are trying to make with this treatment. Everybody can be vulnerable to heroin dependence. But how we are going to treat this, it depends on each path and circumstances. The people we are reaching are people that are really at the end of the rope.
Mm-hmm.
And we prescribing, in this case, injectable heroin, medically prescribed, or injectable hydromorphone, and is another alternative that we are trying to see if this is going to work, is because by the time we, the healthcare system, the social services meet them, they have been in the street for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know? At that point, we need something to re-engage them on the healthcare system. People get very hooked on the idea that we prescribe heroin. The prescribing of the heroin is one tiny portion of what we do. The most important part is the building relationships and re-establishing a way of caring for people that we have not done from the healthcare system for more than 20 years.
Okay, I can hear somebody who hears you say that right now going, okay, well then if that's the most important part is the building of the network and the relationships, then why give them the heroin?
Because if not, they won't come. See? And that is perfect. You know, I was talking to physicians and other, everybody wants to do the right thing and to help with the evidence. So say, if I give my patients all that you guys give across town, they will also do better.
They will what?
Do better.
Yeah.
They can, you know, improve. And I say, yeah, but they won't come 3 times per day for the oral methadone. Not these patients. You see, it seems that the injectable heroin is enough motivation to re-engage them in structured care.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I get it when the media reads, oh, heroin is so like, you know, avant-garde, it feels avant-garde. It's really not that avant-garde.
Does it still feel avant-garde?
Because
we've been sort of marching down this path for close to a quarter century now in different jurisdictions around the world, and for quite some time here in Vancouver.
Yes, you're so right. You should give the interview, you know, because it's totally true. It's not that avant-garde. When people say, oh, this is such an interesting new treatment. No, there is nothing new exactly on what we're doing. We have been trying to do this. What is getting old is for people getting so hooked on the idea that you are enabling drug users. No, you know, we are not enabling anybody. We are just realistic. This is the reality we're facing. What are we going to do to reach people that we have left behind for 20 years? So, yeah, granted, there is the role of the injectable, medically prescribed heroin.
Mm-hmm.
They come because we are giving them the medically prescribed heroin. But that is not the core of what we do. The core of what we do is to build relationships and provide comprehensive care.
So over the last 15 years, you've had a couple of different programs. You had the NAOMI program. Explain what that was.
Well, it's a different one. What we are doing is research, and then we struggle to get policymakers to actually transform the evidence on the research into a program.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so it was a study.
So it was a clinical trial,
yeah,
like the Salem study, and then was with the same basic design than of the European studies, where we compare oral methadone compared to injectable diazepam morphine, that is injectable heroin.
Yeah.
So you randomly assign people to both groups, and the importance of randomized is because then you make sure that there will not be other differences between these two groups beyond what you're going to provide.
And
in
you're
the
not
going to
bias the outcome.
Well, we always bias outcomes. The important thing in research is not to introduce systematic bias.
Yes.
You know, and that's what the randomization does. So we randomized people to oral methadone and to injectable heroin, and it was clear that as in the other clinical trials in Europe, the people that were randomized to injectable heroin did better. What is always important to note when do clinical research is who is your target population? Mm-hmm. And that is something that we cannot stop repeating over and over. This is meant for people that even when we have tried other treatments, they still either don't come or do not benefit sufficiently.
Or they relapse.
Well, relapse will be not benefiting sufficiently.
True.
You see, relapse is a very stigmatizing word. And let me tell you why.
Well, words matter.
Exactly, yeah. And for that reason, I use every time an opportunity to say, relapse puts all the heavy weight on the person. Mm-hmm. When at the end of the day, if we had way more alternatives and a more compassionate, evidence-based care,
yeah.
There will be much less events where people find themselves with nothing else but injecting street heroin.
Which is incredibly dangerous, especially today.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really hard. I was one day at the research office. Of course, I work at UBC and San Paul Hospital, and I came to the research office here in the downtown inside, and one person knocks the door, and he knocks the door, and we receive them, and the research team, the ones that know, and they look like they know what they're doing. And he says, hey, I want to get into the program. And so we always have to say no, because we don't have capacity to do that, and it's not even up to us, the research team. You know, they need to be referred, and there is no capacity. So we try to, like, sit and talk to them and take their names to not just say no and go away. And he said, but you understand that I'm scared of dying. You understand that? With all that passion so that is what it feels, mm-hmm. not to have an alternative way of doing drugs.
Yeah. Death is an ever-present companion.
How that works in your life, you know, it's very complicated. It's mm-hmm. very hard for us even to think of research when mm-hmm. that is the reality that people face. Granted, there is budgets and policymakers and all that, but at some point, we will have to be brave and push for treatments that are evidence-based and compassionate.
So you get the evidence from the NAOMI
yes.
clinical survey.
It's clinical trial.
Trial.
Thank you.
And that leads us to Salome.
Well, I tell you why it led us to Salome, because even when we showed that pharmaceutical grade heroin was much more effective mm-hmm. than oral methadone for this particular small and important minority, we couldn't get approved.
You still couldn't get approved, even though you had evidence-based mm-hmm. information.
Yes.
So you had to go back and do it again.
Well, no, we did something different. We had a very small group of people receiving another opiate painkiller called hydromorphone. Mm-hmm. As potent as diacetylmorphine, similar, very similar. Opiates are very similar, although we react very differently to them, but they're very similar. Mm-hmm. So we said, okay, what if this other injectable opioid might be an alternative to injectable heroin, given that the federal government is not going to approve, and nobody seems to want to pay. Mm-hmm. So we did what is called a non-inferiority study, that is kind of like asking, is hydromorphone as good as medically prescribed heroin?
And
we did show that yes. You know, granted, the patients want the pharmaceutical grade heroin. After 100 years of promoting that this is the drug everybody wants, it's very difficult for this other drug to, you know, compete in mm-hmm. that way. All the evidence comes from pharmaceutical grade heroin. But this drug, if you don't have the pharmaceutical grade heroin, this drug seems to be working. Mm-hmm. So now we have this other alternative that we can put on the table. There are some physicians that have been pushing for start prescribing hydromorphone to their patients. So there is 1, 2, 3 people doing this, try to advocate to mm-hmm. provide a clean, you know, medically prescribed opioid to people as an alternative to the street.
Mm-hmm. So how many people were in the Salome program?
202. And right now the clinic has around 140 people with receiving either injectable hydromorphone or injectable heroin.
As a result of Salome?
Yes, as a result of Salome.
So where are we at as far as you getting the funding, getting the support from the provincial and federal government to be able to continue this program? Because Salome's finished, right?
The clinical trial is finished.
But so the people who were involved are still being treated.
Receiving at Crosstown Clinic.
Crosstown Clinic, yeah.
This is one of the parts of the story of doing clinical research that are the ones that always give me that warm feeling that there is so much so many people trying to do good, and regardless of ideologies, you know. At some point, Providence Healthcare, that it is a Catholic institution, took a stand and said, we're not going to let these patients in the street. So they advocated for the federal government to allow to continue prescribing injectable heroin, and they pushed provincially to continue prescribing injectable hydromorphone. At the end of the day, it was very clear for Providence Healthcare that this has nothing to do with the medication itself. It has to do with taking care of the most vulnerable people injecting street drugs. And that was...
It's about taking care of people.
Yes, exactly. It's just the people we are reaching, there is not much for them around because... Mm-hmm. has been too long. They have been left behind for too long, so there's too much to repair.
But has legislation changed? Is the provincial government getting behind this yet? Is the federal government getting behind it? Are they saying, yes, okay, we agree, or are they still sitting on the fence?
Well, the federal government, what they did was to reverse what Rona Ambrose messed with. You know, there is a special access program for any medication. If you need a medication that is not licensed in Canada, and you can demonstrate to Health Canada mm-hmm. that this is the only one that is going to help you, they will provide you with a special access permit. So Ron Ambrose just said that diacetylmorphine should be out of that. And, you know, that political party used that as a way of gaining votes because, you know, it's very scary to say, you know, these people are trying to put heroin in the streets. Exactly know what we do, but you know, everybody runs with whatever they want. So after that, you know, Providence Healthcare went to, you know, challenge this decision of Rona Ambrose. We got an injunction. And when the government changed, what they did is to put things back as they were. That there is no restrictions on what medications can be requested for SAPs.
Okay, but who's paying for it? Well, Providence.
You should ask that to Providence, but it's not being paid right now through the provincial government because it's not in the pharmacy. It's not licensed in Canada.
But does not the provincial government and police and courts and mental health care workers and so many other different agencies that become the next you know, stop along the way for people who are facing these challenges,
Absolutely.
Do they not benefit?
Oh, they do. And they want it. You see, the part that is most important, that is the care, that is the majority of the costs come from the people, the staffing, the physicians and nurses.
Yeah.
That's the majority of the cost. The medication itself is a small part. So that is the majority of the cost. But if exactly as you say, if you think that around each patient is going to cost around $25,000 per
year. Yeah.
And then you have research from independent sources saying that to us as a society, it costs us $40,000 to have people untreated.
Mm-hmm.
It is a no-brainer in terms of money.
Yes.
You know, so it is important that the police is so supportive of what we are doing.
Right. Because they become first responders.
As they say, then we can actually take care of the police matter. At the end of the day, these are healthcare matters
or right.
psychosocial matter. So they are very excited. But you know, it seems these things, I think we're going to get there, but it's taken, you know, we need more people that are brave, that want to take the stand.
Who are those people that need to take a stand? Is it all of us? Or
absolutely, all of us. But you doing this interview, you are taking a stand. Mm-hmm. You see, people think that this is just coming from one place. No, this comes from everywhere. What kind of community do we want to be? Do we want to be a community that leaves behind people that already had it very hard? Or we want to be a community that says, let's take care of everybody in the way we can? Of course, challenges in the middle, you know, all the time. The other day, the lead nurse of our clinic was talking about how she works with the patients. So empowering. She was saying, so, you know, these patients comes and said, I don't know what I'm going to do with my dog. You know, there was an issue with the dog. You can imagine that nurses are not trained to deal what to do with this SPCA mm-hmm. and all that. And this is what she says to the patients. You know what? I don't know what I'm going to do about your dog. But whatever it is, we're going to do this together. Yes. That's the community I want to belong to. A community that says, I don't know how we're going to move forward, where we are going to find the money, but let's do it together.
And that is the key, isn't it?
It's the key. You know, that's the key.
That's the world that we want to live in. At least, I hope that that's where we as a country are going. There are other signs around the world that scare me that we're not moving in that direction, but hopefully in Canada we can continue to move in that direction. I applaud you for the work that you do.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay.